This is a session where David, and where's Campbell?
Right behind you.
Campbell's behind me. That's obviously Ken. And questions now to any one of those. Generally, you can either have your question directly to the open. Here's Elizabeth. Elizabeth, I will let you stand in front of the mic here.
And if we don't agree, we'll go at each other.
That's right. So the questions can be to anybody, or you can direct them. And they're going to have some fun competing with each other. There you go.
Okay, we got Jeremy here first, I guess.
Thank you. What exactly are our limitations on recommending change in the number of seats in the Legislative Assembly?
Sure. Do you want to speak to that, Jack? The mandate speaks about seats and the votes, and the Assembly is currently 79, and we interpret the mandate to mean that we're looking at the electoral system to produce those 79 seats, not some different number.
I am not one of the four wise political scientists, but I will comment on that as well. I have actually discussed this with the original report writer, Gordon Gibson, as well as, of course, when I received the mandate. And indeed, they wish us to stay to 79. There's one very good reason for that, and that is that if a recommendation were to change the system plus to increase the number of seats, let's say by 20 or 30 or whatever, that could be the issue in a referendum and not the change in system. And Elizabeth is nodding her head, saying that could very well be. So I think we think our mandate is 79.
Thank you.
Who's fielding questions?
I guess I better do that. Bill? Where's Bill? Jackson. Bill. Okay.
In our discussion group, the point came up that often in our current plurality system, we vote against a government. Is there any data that shows in, say, a list system or an STV system that the voters are more positive in that they actually vote for something as opposed to get rid of something?
Who wants to start?
I'm not sure. I need to think about that one. My initial answer is to say that it's probably about the same almost everywhere you look, except that the context of the electoral system might affect the extent to which you vote for party or for candidate, or in this case, vote against party or against candidates, so that in some electoral systems there might be a bit of a candidate focus. But I'm not sure about whether there's a policy implication in terms of voting for or against government across the systems. I'm just not sure of that.
Sheila?
Yes, I'm over here.
Yeah.
This question's for Elizabeth. You were talking about some of the disruption that happened in New Zealand, kind of the turmoil and change and all of the difficulty with that. In our groups, we're talking about stable governments, and my concern is probably more about whether a government is effective rather than stable. Did you find that the government in New Zealand was effective through that change?
Well, it is a difficult question because we'd all probably have different values that we'd want implemented. But if we think about parliamentary systems, we have to consider that governments need to be able to pass some legislation. I mean, we don't want everything to stop. We don't want the system to be so full of obstacles that when we elect a parliament, in fact, the government can't do anything and implement its policies. That hasn't happened in New Zealand. Yes, there's been negotiation between coalition partners and between governments and their supporting parties, but they've been able to put through their legislative measures. And so there's been some quite distinctive changes that have occurred, if that is the definition of effectiveness. Thank you.
Just a rider. Don't forget, governments only need parliaments for new things. When a government comes to power, it has an incredible range of powers, things it can do without changing legislation. So one of the tricks about stable government or effective government, how it carries on the day-to-day business of government is a matter for the executive. It's not a matter for parliament. It's only the government only needs the parliament when it wants to do new things, by and large.
Alan?
A question for Elizabeth. You had mentioned there was, I think, 2002, there was a snap election. Could you give a little bit of background of why a snap election was called? Our group was in our discussion trying to think of what was the circumstance there.
There are several reasons. The main one was that the junior coalition party, called the Alliance, split, and although those ministers still continued in cabinet, it did weaken the authority of government, it was felt, particularly as the government had campaigned on being a stable government in the previous 1999 election, and also because that government had put forward some legislation that tried to penalise individual MPs who defected from their parties. So it wasn't a good look for the government. We also think that probably the government feared that there might be some bad economic news round the corner, which, as it happened, there wasn't. And so the government went in a July instead of perhaps November. So it wasn't a very early election, but I think the government decided that it... Also, the other thing was that the Labour Party, the senior coalition partner, was riding very high in the polls at the time, and I think it thought it just might squeak through with a single party, as a single party majority government. It didn't.
Derek.
What was the reaction in New Zealand to larger electorate sizes?
I don't know of any survey evidence that looks at voter reactions, so I'm sorry, I don't know. We do have survey evidence about contact between constituents and MPs, and it tends to go up and down according to the times and the needs and how much unemployment there is and things like that, and it's low at the moment. So I don't know. It's the MPs who seem to find it more difficult than the citizens, but I don't have better data. Sorry.
Thanks. Douglas.
Elizabeth, we're going to call you back up again. With the mixed member system in New Zealand that you've had, have you found that there has been a fairly stable set of policies with the coalition governments? Or when we have the current system we have here in BC, as you change from one government to another, there's quite often very strong policy shifts. Whereas what you have in New Zealand, have you seen it to be more stable, or has there been very strong policy shifts when there has been a change of coalitions?
We had strong policy shifts under the former electoral system, and what has happened is that the coalition negotiations have tended to moderate dramatic policy swings. So, for example, in 1996, New Zealand First negotiated to have free healthcare for under 6-year-olds. Well, that certainly wasn't the policy of the National Party, which wanted to go as far as possible as privatising the health system as possible, which the people didn't want, for an example. Thanks.
Rob?
My question goes to anybody who can answer it, possibly. In our group, we were discussing the mixed system, and we were wondering, because what you said about not being able to increase the size of the legislature, so if you were going with a mixed system, you'd have to increase the size of the ridings, pardon me, and to free up at least 25% of the vote, 25% of the members for proportional. We were wondering if you could allow the rural ridings to remain the same and make the ridings that did exist in the urban centers to be made them be proportional members. Would that be possible, or would that kind of contravene the 2.5 representative rule? Thank you.
I think it would be a tricky constitutional case. On the surface, the argument would seem to be no, that constituents have to be equally sized. But I suppose a lawyer might also argue, though, that if the final results were proportional in terms of party terms, that would be a kind of equality and effectiveness that a court might recognize as acceptable. I mean, my basic instinct would be that the courts would probably say that was unconstitutional. But we have no jurisprudence in this kind of area at all. And there are probably lawyers who have better ideas than I, but I think they're likely to say no. But it would be fun to try and make the argument to persuade them.
Campbell, and a follow-up.
I'd like to ask Ken a question. If if you took out, if you had the Lower Mainland as one electoral district and allocated the members proportionally, I can't see how that would make any constitutional rule.
I guess the issue is whether the number of voters in the district per member.
If it was identical, if you had single member districts in...
That's a different kind of question. That's a very different kind of question, because the premise of Rob's question was, could you have geographically smaller and a population, in effect, population hold the size of it. So population smaller single member districts in one part of the province and population larger single member districts in another part of the province. I think that would be hard to get through a court, but you might be able to argue that the proportionality kind of overruled it at some level. I don't think so, but it would be, let's say, fun to try. But the multi-member, single-member thing would be, that's a whole different kind of set of questions, and again, we don't know what, judges have never thought about that under our Constitution. Because the interesting thing about the constitutional decisions is that it provides for not equal vote, but effective representation, a phrase that is amenable to all kind of fudging by judges.
Can I do a follow-up question?
A quick follow-up, yep.
So then, if I understand you correctly, the only way we could really do a mixed system would be to dramatically increase the size of every riding and then take the resulting leftover MPs and then make them proportional, elected on some kind of the open or closed list system throughout the province. Is that a correct
assessment?
Well,
remember, we talked about mixed systems. We talked about lots of different kinds of mixed systems. If you want to have a constituency plus list kind of mixed system, however they're amalgamated, that's right. But remember, there was various other kinds of mixes. But that particular kind of mix would seem to dictate that equation.
Thank you.
I mean, if I could just add, I mean, an alternative mix to follow on that you could consider going for would be a mix of STV and AV.
Yes.
And indeed, that's been talked about in the past, in the early part of the last century for the United Kingdom, that in the rural areas where you have far-flung constituencies, you go for an alternative vote, single-member constituency, and keep it small. And then in the bigger urban areas, you go for multi-member, single transferable vote. So that could be another kind of mixed system.
That system actually was used in this country, David, in two provinces for big chunks of time in the middle of the last century.
Okay.
We talked about that last time, but that's a fundamentally different kind of mix.
I'm going to jump because I think Taya wants to come in on this point, right?
Well, actually, I just had a question on that, because isn't that the system they employ in Alberta right now?
No, that was a system that used to be used in Alberta, that kind of mix.
What do they use right now?
They now use a system like ours. They use a single-member system. And the Socreds went to that in the 1950s when the opposition won three or four seats. And, you know, they don't like that kind of stuff in Alberta, so... So they switched to this system to try and really even shut them down.
Okay, Julie?
Trying to decide which questions I'm going to ask. Are we going to be discussing the ballot structure more? Yesterday, David, you touched on quite a bit on ballot structure, and I found it really interesting in the linkage between electoral system and the support and the linkage between the voters and the ballot structure. And it's really fascinating and I think really important. Are we going to have an opportunity as a group to talk about ballot structure and split versus non-split votes and so on?
Well, I think it's inevitable we'll come to those kinds of questions when we get to the specifics of any. If you decide you want to recommend an alternate system, those are some of the kinds of considerations that will inevitably get onto the table pretty quickly.
David, where are you, David? Yeah.
My question is for David, but I'd also be interested in comments that Ken or Campbell or Elizabeth might have. David, towards the end of your presentation this morning, you talked about issues for consideration in electoral system design, and you talked about voter link with suggestions that an STP or an open list system would be suggested in that situation if that was your priority. I can't remember who it was, but I think someone here had mentioned at some point in time that in systems like that, where you have candidates from the same party competing against one another, you get a very strong focus on local issues, perhaps to the detriment of more global issues. Would you care to comment?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's an extremely difficult one to get very right. I mean, let me give you the answer as a spouse of a politician elected under a closed list system for the European Parliament. She's very happy, and of course, therefore, I'm very happy that it's a closed list system, because she doesn't have to engage in chasing personal votes and looking after constituency interests. Rather, she has to focus on what goes on with the party. Once you go down the road towards ballot papers becoming more and more open, which is getting back to Julie's question, then you have to entertain the idea that the politicians are going to be working that bit harder to chase their personal votes. And it's a well-known criticism of the single transferable vote, at least as used in Ireland, that this encourages some pretty, in some cases, pretty extreme, awful constituency competitions, sometimes even between politicians from the same party. In fact, sometimes, and this is something that Ken wrote about many years ago, sometimes it's worse for the campaign that goes on between candidates from the same party. But I go back to something I think I said in the lecture. The difficulty with looking at that is whether that is so much an issue to do with the nature of the single transferable vote system or just the way party politics is run in Ireland. And it's very, very difficult to separate those two things. But certainly to get to your question, it's something one has to consider as a possibility, that if you go down the road towards open list or STB, you might get a certain style of constituency representation which is good but may not be so good.
I think it's a matter of, you know, in some sense at the end of the day, who's contesting the election? Is it individual candidates or is it organizations, namely political parties? And when it's individual candidates, they're driven to kind of try and build as many very personal connections between themselves and the voters as they can, because they want a vote that comes to them as a person. And different ballot structure will provide incentives to behave one way or another way. When it's an organization, they want the candidates to go out and just say good things about the party, and the voters have no say on the individuals. And so there's a whole different kind of set of relationships.
If I can add something from the opposite direction to your question, but it sort of gets to some of the point. The British members of the European Parliament used to be elected in individual constituencies. Now they're elected in regional closed lists. Many of them have shut down their offices, their constituency offices. They have a token gesture in the constituency. Their constituency mailbag has shrunk to very, very little now. They're not engaged anymore in maintaining contact with their voters. And that's in the space of about 4 years that change has happened. So there definitely is an electoral system effect going on there.
I'd just like to refer to Tasmania and two things. Part of the effect...
We had to have it.
Yeah. Part of the effect is, my understanding, in Ireland, very often the fiercest fights were in three-person seats. So it was really a vote that would certainly support one candidate from one party, but not two. But Tasmania's had up to five, six, and seven candidates, and there the personal rivalry may exist, but it tends to be more diffuse. But you're right, that for much of one of the criticisms of STV in Tasmania was it did encourage brokerage politics. By five large regions, and exacerbated to a certain extent by rivalry less between candidates than between candidates and regions. But on the other hand, Tasmania has had periods when it's made systemic change. It depends on the politics and whatever. So there's a logic. All electoral systems have a logic which pushes in a certain direction, but it doesn't mean that in any given context it will produce exactly the same result. So STV has a bearing in that direction, but you can offset it, as was mentioned earlier, by other rules and other incentives.
RB.
Thank you. I have two small questions. First is about the three-tier systems in Austria and Greece. In two-tier systems, it's straightforward, we understand. The first tier could be at the regional level and the next at the national level. What is the basis of having a third tier in those countries? Has it been designed to address rural, urban, or any other form of representative imbalance without sacrificing equality of votes? And if so, how?
I'm scared you're going to look at me, Ken. I don't know is the short answer. I would need to read my notes. It's been ages since I've looked at both of those countries. All I can remember from memory is that in the Greece case, there was a deliberate attempt to try and make the system less than proportional. So they maneuvered the electoral system in such a way to make sure that the majority, the party with the biggest number of votes, got the biggest number of seats. So it more or less ceased to be a proportional system. That's my understanding. Austria, I just don't know. I'm sure it has some other purpose, but I couldn't answer.
Well, my second question is, I believe from Elizabeth's speech, what I understood was on the PR side, the entire country is treated as one electoral district. And if so, do the New Zealands also have regionalized list? And if so, how does it really work to get people from all the regions?
Yes, you're quite right. It's one nationwide party list. But the major parties, anyway, construct their lists by using their regional organisations, and the regional delegates will vote for the list. The Labour Party, which has stressed representativeness of social groups more than the National Party, has a system whereby after every five people are selected on the list, the group of people who are making the selection and casting their votes consider the representativeness for age, region, gender, ethnicity. And then they go on and do the next five, keeping that in mind. So it's just like a nudge more than anything else. So, okay, the parties construct their regional, and the major parties construct their regional lists, and then there's a knitting together meeting. But that is much more dominated by the party central bureaucrats and the party leaders. All the parties tend to construct their lists in different ways.
Thank you. Shawnee?
I'd be interested in both what Elizabeth and David have to say on this. We've talked a lot about accountability, or the question of accountability in coalition governments, and whether that's a problem for the electorate to identify who's responsible for what. And Elizabeth, you mentioned this afternoon some things that parties do in coalitions to differentiate themselves. And I'm wondering if both of you can talk about parties differentiating themselves within coalitions and how that affects accountability.
Yeah, accountability is, I was watching your discussion. It's not an easy one to. There is this sort of, where some of that question tends to come from is people look at Germany and they say, oh, the Free Democratic Party, the third party, has almost always been in government. So you can never kick the rascals out, so you can never have change. But there, on one hand, that's Germany. That's just the way party politics has turned out there. And of course, that no longer applies now. They're not currently, there have been ways of getting them out. But there is a certain question mark about whether getting the rascals out is really the issue. And I'm not sure I'm getting your question right here, so forgive me if I'm going off on a tangent.
It's more how the different parties would differentiate themselves to the voters.
I think a lot of that might be country-based. I mean, in Ireland, there is often a problem for smaller parties in coalitions about whether their identity is going to be swallowed up and whether they're going to be under threat come the next election. And so you find them falling in and falling out of coalition from election to election. But in much of continental Europe, the coalitions may be more long-term. There's more of an understanding that you might stay with the same set of parties from one election to the next, and therefore it's less of a problem. Now, Ireland has only recently moved down the road towards regular coalition governments, much like New Zealand. And so whether there's an issue about the smaller parties worrying about their identity is something that's unique to, is that's characteristic of countries that haven't had many coalition governments. I don't know. I don't know, Elizabeth, if there's something you could add.
I don't think there is anything I can add, actually.
Thank you.
Jeremy. Pass. Okay. Edith.
Elizabeth, I was wondering, when New Zealand switched, like, we're a very polarized electorate, left and right, we just go back and forth. With the two-vote system, how long did it take people to decide to split the vote, or what percentage actually do split their vote, and why do they?
At the very first election, over a third split their vote. So, and they've continued to do that, increasing numbers. They split the vote partly because they get used to their local MP, and if the local MP does a good job, they vote for that MP because they want that MP to continue regardless of whether they agree with the party or not. They split their votes also for strategic reasons because they might think that the party they favour might need a junior coalition party, so they might give their vote to a minor party in order to increase the minor party vote for the party vote and thus give the minor party a better chance of getting into Parliament. So there's a range of reasons why people split their votes. It's not necessarily just a donkey vote. It can be quite a deliberate thing. And there's survey evidence that voters have a good understanding of how that works.
Thank you. Kerry?
Question for David. Could you give us two or three main reasons why you and the majority of Northern Ireland voters favour the STV system over other electoral systems?
It's pure irrationality. it's just the way I was brought up is the thing I'm most familiar with. That's my off-the-cuff answer, but that's an unfair answer. I favour it personally because it is kind of nice to keep politicians on their toes, and particularly I think for what we might call lower level elections. I could see a rationale why perhaps for a national parliament in a large political system there might be a question mark over, you know, the cohesion of your parliament and the relationship between parliament and the executive. You might understand that, but I would have thought for regional level elections and certainly for lower level elections, there's no particular reason why a single transferable vote can't be used. And it does have an awful lot of virtues, but of course it does have a certain number of vices. Now, when you say a lot of people support it, I mean, in the Irish Republic, they've been asked twice in a referendum whether they want to get rid of it, and they've on both occasions voted against. But as often is the case, they very often, what they are probably doing is voting against it because the government wanted them to vote for it. It doesn't necessarily mean that they like the single
yeah, they're Irish
system. So it's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's an attempt.
There's a lot of Blaneys in Ireland, too. Margaret.
Thank you. In our group, we were talking about the value of social groups and being considered women's participation and participation by visible minorities and so on. And certainly we were for it. But when we came down to discussing more specific things, like whether there might be a role for designated seats for Aboriginal people in BC, there was much less clarity, I think. And I know that in New Zealand that has a very specific history through the treaty and so on. But I'm wondering if there are examples in other places where there have been designated seats and what the experience has been. I think in India there may be seats for scheduled castes and for tribal peoples. I think in the States there have been attempts to gerrymander seats that would be primarily Indian. But I'm not sure where else, in Australia or wherever.
There are a few other examples. I mean, in Ireland for a while, in the Irish Republic, they had seats for Protestants. They phased that out after a while. But so that there are a couple of other examples. But I guess one way of getting an answer to your question could be to suggest, and that was intimated, I think, in Elizabeth's presentation, is that you have less need for reserved seats as you move down the road towards proportionality, because by, in effect, proportionality will increase social representation.
But does that work where you have a very small minority, as First Nations are in BC?
I mean, that's a fair question. I can't answer that.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it would depend on the kind of system and the kind of political parties and the party's approach to running candidates and so on. If you had a list system and parties made a deliberate decision to include any particular groups, that would happen. If they made a decision that they weren't going to do that and the group was quite small, then that wouldn't happen. So, I mean, electoral systems provide the frameworks that give some, they have a logic. And the question is how far following that logic to political parties and to individual politicians and candidates want to go. When they want to pursue it aggressively, they can go farther down that road. When they have no interest in going down that road, the logic may be there, but it's not going to be implemented.
There were seats for many years in Ireland and the UK for university graduates.
Still are in Ireland.
Okay. Elizabeth.
Yes. The whole issue of Māori seats is very controversial in New Zealand. People are pretty divided on it. And so it's because it can be interpreted as giving some people a special privilege. And so it is always going to be a controversial kind of solution to one of the oldest issues in politics of all, the issue of minority rights. Having said that, I think it has performed an interesting role in New Zealand because it has meant that there were always four Māori in Parliament. Their culture was always, therefore, recognised, even if they were overruled on far too many issues, weren't treated as they should have been. But it also has meant that Māori representation had to be encompassed in the new system. It had to be dealt with. Now, the Royal Commission actually recommended that those seats be abolished, but it was Māori representations to Parliament that persuaded Parliament to retain them and, in fact, to allow them to rise and fall as people registered on them. Thank you.
Craig.
Question?
I'll make one up fast.
You did have your name up, Craig.
Okay. I'll ask a question about list systems and if the qualities of the people on the list systems, on the closed list in New Zealand, are they political hacks or are they very qualified individuals?
Depends which list.
Yes. You know, we want so much from our politicians. On the one hand, we want them to show that they work for the party, have put in the hard yards, servicing the party, working for it. On the other hand, when people do that, we call them hacks. I mean, I think it is a bit of a problem. But that's my preliminary statement. I think that what the major parties have done is just sort of crammed all the top places with their people. And so the lower places become the interesting places which can be contested. And parties have also tried to use the list to drop people who haven't been effective and bring in new people. So a lot depends on the party, a lot depends on expectations. But one thing we learned in the last election was that the media played a very, very important role, should play a very, very important role in publicising the lists, whether these are closed lists or open lists. Of course, if they're open lists, it's very important that people find out about who are on those lists so they can make rational kinds of reasons for reordering the list. If they're closed lists, it's equally important because when United Future suddenly went in the last election from one member who people knew about to I can't remember how many members and became part of government, everyone said, who on earth are they? Because after the first election, they hadn't been given the media publicity to the creation of the list, except for the major parties. So the media has a very important role, democratic role in this. It's not only the official public education, you know, sending out the information and information on television. It's also the media asking questions and questions about those people. They're part of the equation.
Got about 10 people on the list, and that will take us to 5 o'clock. We will conclude at 5. Craig, that was just to see if you were awake. It's Craig number 2 who asked the question.
It was a good question, though, bro. My question was actually partially answered, but I'm going to give David an opportunity to answer anyways. I wanted him to sell me on the STV system.
Where do I begin? I think one way in which I would sell it is with the fact that there's no such thing as a safe seat, and it is kind of nice in this growingly cynical age to have a situation where the politicians are aware of that, and we have had plenty of examples in Ireland. I mean, the leader of the Labour Party at one stage lost his seat. A former foreign minister of Ireland lost his seat. And that's it. You're out. There's no way of coming in as a what's the phrase Ken's been using? Zombie. We don't have zombies. Well, we have zombies, maybe, but I know we don't. So there's that. But there's the other one. I always remember my first political memory. Sometime in the 70s, I asked my father which party he voted for. And he said, I vote for all of them. And that's one of the beauties for the voter. It's the freedom to choose, that you can literally, if you want to, vote for every single person on that ballot paper. Or if you only want to vote for one of them, that's fine as well. And you know that there's a chance that if your preferred person doesn't get through, somebody else might make it. So I guess there's two openers.
Anna?
This question's for Elizabeth. When you were making your presentation earlier, you were saying that coalition governments form their coalitions in secret, or was it policy making? Because the question came up in our discussion group about transparency, mm-hmm. And would you say that the current system in New Zealand is more or less transparent than the previous system?
Ooh. Well, that's a big one. I think there are two issues. There are three issues here. The first issue is what happens before an election. Do parties declare who they want to make a coalitions with? Well, we've had it both ways, and there's no doubt it's better if you can better make a sensible choice if you know where the partnerships are. The second question is how parties then make their formal agreements between them to make a government. I don't think you can ask for transparency in this. You can't have negotiations that are exposed to the world. It's just not on. I think you just get far too much playing to the public and not enough serious negotiation. And people would be far too unwilling to give way because you'd be showing compromise publicly. So I don't think there's any call for openness at the negotiation stage of a government. The third issue is, of course, a bigger system issue, is whether you have open government generally, whether the society has freedom of information availability, whether Parliament's procedures are open to attend, whether you can freely give submissions at select committees. And they are bigger things that are really beyond the brief of an electoral system choice. I don't think I've answered your question, but...
There's a perception that perhaps there's backroom deals in coalition governments that wouldn't happen in the current system.
Well, not sure that's fair. It's yes and no, because yes, there are backroom deals.
Yeah.
When it's at the committee stage, you pretty we find out through our press very quickly what the deals are. And if you've got an active press, it just comes out straight away when the government puts forward legislation and then the changes start occurring. But, you know, there are backroom deals in big catch-all parties as well, between the different factions, between the left and the right, the rural, the urban. Yeah.
Janet? Question? Did you have a question, Janet?
No. Sorry.
Oh. Sherry? Been answered? Okay. Rob, second question.
With regarding to open lists, could you eliminate the constituency question, like the competition between members if you just made it a province-wide list? Would that eliminate the competition between the party individual party members inside a party?
Yeah, that's a nice one. There's different ways of looking at that. You could argue that if you increase the size of the district to province-wide, that's going to make it unmanageable and very difficult for the individual candidates to do the sort of game playing that you get in openness systems. But against that, what you're going to find, and you know, there's already some evidence even in Finland of this, in Finnish European Parliament elections, where the whole country is one district, that the richer candidates, the better resourced candidates, are doing presidential elections. So they're buying in consultants, they're spending a fortune on personal campaigning. So you might lose some element of the constituency, the bad bits of the constituency focus, but you might bring in other elements that are not so good.
I'm sorry, we just look at the names. We've got about 8 or 9 names. I think we're going to keep to that, okay? I keep on accepting more. This will be it. You have a chance after dinner. Amanda, you're next.
Hi, this is a question for Elizabeth. I just wanted to know, you put quite the positive spin on the New Zealand system. I'm way over here. Sorry. Hi. And I just wanted to know if you found any negative or at least challenging things that you've noticed in the system with the mixed member proportional system with New Zealand.
Any particularly challenging ones?
Yeah.
Or unexpected or negatives?
Negative things.
Ah, about the system itself or the way people have worked it? I mean,
the way people have worked in New Zealand.
Well, I actually, personally, I'd prefer an open list, even though I know that there are arguments in favour of closed lists as far as representativeness is concerned. Personally, I dislike the one-seat threshold. It's too easy to get, and it can make for party fragmentation in the House, too many small parties. Personally, I think that if you're going to go to any new electoral system, one needs to think very carefully about democratic choice of candidates and have a good body of law that makes parties select their candidates democratically and define what democratically means. Our law says that parties must select their candidates democratically, but doesn't define what that means. And so in the one case that was brought, it went nowhere at all because there was no definition. So they're just some of the things off the top of my head that I think I would change if I had the power, which I never will. Thanks.
Chris.
Well, I think Elizabeth just answered the one question that I had that was burning in my mind. The other one that Elizabeth commented on some time ago, and my ears really perked up, we've talked a fair bit about how we must make whatever system we choose, we must make it simple for the electorate to understand. I heard Elizabeth say that in New Zealand, the voters are using split votes on an increasing
percentage.
Yes. Now, that would indicate to me, like you mentioned, that they would cast a second vote for a smaller party, hoping that that would be large enough to form a coalition. That would certainly indicate to me that the voters are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, and I'm sure that's not just in New Zealand. So I don't think it's that important that we concentrate on trying to make a system simple as long as we make it effective.
Bob, did you ask a question? Fred. Another Bob. Sorry, Bob.
Yes, this is for Elizabeth. She always talks about a coalition government. Is there usually just two or three seats separating the two main parties, or are they always a very tight race?
It was quite a tight race in 1996, but not in 1999 or 2002. The National centre-right major party had been effectively in power from 1990 onwards, And by 1999, the voters really dismissed it quite soundly. So, and the Labour Alliance government came in. So, but it was a minority government. So, yeah.
Sorry, Bob. Fred.
Well, I would like to go back to in our discussion group this afternoon. We were talking about accountability. And the question came up, when we speak about accountability, just exactly what are we talking about? Accountable to whom? Are accountable to the voter or accountable to the legislature? Perhaps it can be a little clarified. The other question I have, and I'm not too certain, talk about how we have to increase the size of constituencies. It would seem to me that rather than thinking in terms of size or increasing size of constituency, we should be thinking in terms of amalgamating the current constituencies wherever possible in order to arrive in a multiple member constituency. Am I correct or am I wrong?
Well, the first question about accountability is an interesting one, because the classic argument really kind of suggests that single member majority governments are more directly accountable to the voters, because at election time they can see who is responsible, they can vote to keep them in or to put them out. And those kind of governments aren't not as accountable to parliaments, because they have a majority and they can pretty much do as they want. On the other hand, governments that are more accountable to parliaments, perhaps because they're a coalition of three or four parties and they have to compromise and they have to depend on parliamentary support, are perhaps not as accountable to voters, because the voters are not clear as to which partner is exactly responsible for which action of the government. So in some sense, there's a kind of fine balance maybe between accountability to voters and accountability to parliaments. That if you increase one, you may decrease the other. Or in practice, that's been the experience. And so it's a kind of trade-off sort of question.
Can I just come in?
Please, David.
I agree completely with you, and I guess the only thing I would add is that ultimately, if you ask the voters, the evidence suggests that the voters feel more satisfied in proportional systems with coalition governments. The survey evidence demonstrates this. And the best source I can think of for this, it might be in your reading suggestions, is a Dutch political scientist called Leipart. In his latest book, Patterns of Democracy, in the last two chapters, he shows pretty categorically, I think few people dispute this, that on the whole, voters are happier. And that would suggest that voters have a sense that politicians are more accountable, the governments are more accountable.
I'd like to give a different spin on it. I think Fred's onto something really important. I think there are different kinds of things. I don't think they're necessarily trade-offs. So, for example, if you remember back way the distant past in the second weekend, if you want a parliament which operates, watches an executive very closely, then you need a minority government. Okay. So if you chose the electoral system, my graduate students a test is how could you devise an electoral system that always produced minority governments? That's a tricky test. But that's really important. If that's the major criterion, if that's what you want, then it doesn't matter whether it's closed list, open list, half open, STV, whatever it is. That's a dominant question. But if you're interested in representation, if the body itself, you want to make it representative, and you're more interested in that than the effect, the consequences for the operation of Parliament, then a whole different other set of criteria operate. So Ken, as ever, is almost right, and that is that. These two are related. They're related, but they're not. They're kind of different views. They rest on different assumptions about what the purpose of the electoral system is for.
Johnny goes to prove there's not only no perfect political system, but there's no or electoral system, but there's no perfect political scientist either.
Well, he comes from. remember, he comes from the country that's upside down at the bottom of the globe, right?
Two last questions. Rick, I can't find you. Where are you, Rick? There he is. Rick.
Thanks, Jack. Questions for Elizabeth. 2002, the Labor Party had 41.3%, and they amalgamated or formed a coalition with two of the smaller parties. I can't remember which ones. What I'm curious about is the supporters of the small parties that formed the coalition. What was the reaction to the small parties joining the large party? Was it viewed as a sellout by the supporters, or were they happy that they're playing with the big boys now?
Well, it was a coalition of just two parties, Labour and Progressive Coalition, and that had been clearly indicated before the election. The Progressive Coalition was a rump of a party that split earlier on, the year before, the Alliance Party. I know it's very complicated. But so everyone, all the voters knew, and the party supporters knew of Progressive Coalition, that they were going to form a coalition if they had the numbers. The party, United Future Party, well, that was the one that surprisingly jumped up in the polls and went from one to whatever it was. You've got the figures in front of you. I think they're just a support party. They don't have ministers in the government. And their philosophy is very much that you support the largest party. So their supporters would have been happy. The Greens, where there was just informal agreements on particular policy issues, the Greens had supported Labour in the previous 3 years. And it has been a bit of a rocky relationship, particularly on genetic engineering issues. On the other hand, the Greens did not want to see a right-wing party in power. So it was in their interest to keep Labour there, but not to get too close. Does that answer? That's the various motivations.
Yeah, just to make it clear, you said yes. There was only two parties?
There are only two parties in the government, but it was a minority coalition government.
Of the three parties, though? You said the UF?
So Progressive Coalition is one party.
Yes.
Yep. And Labour is one party.
Okay.
So it was a two-party minority coalition.
Where did the UF
government
come in to play?
United Future just signed an agreement saying, okay, we will support you on issues of the budget, and if a vote of confidence comes into the House. In return, we want certain things. And they wanted a family commission, and they wanted more non-government MPs to have chairmanships of select committees, and they got both of those, and a few other things.
Thanks.
And then, Jean, you didn't get your question this morning, but you got the honor of the last question tonight.
Thank you. David, given the very attractive attributes of the STV system, why were those new democracies, only Estonia got it for one shot and then they changed it? Can you enlighten us as to some of the background, why those new democracies never even selected it, or did it come up on their radar screen?
I mean, in some cases, it's a great question. In some cases, they, in their deliberations, in the round table discussions in some of those new democracies, they specifically ruled it out as a system they did not want. I think the best possible answer I could give is that the single transferable vote system is not exactly a party elite friendly system. And if the party elite are in control of the design of the electoral system through whatever mechanism they've established, it's extremely unlikely that this is the system they're going to go for. One of the reasons why STV originates in many countries when it originates, Malta and Ireland are the two best known examples, the Australian upper house, is for the stark reason that it was, certainly in the case of Malta and Ireland this works, that it was colonial and experimentation by the British. A British person invented the single transferable vote, and it looked like an attractive system. They didn't want to try it out on Britain, so they said, let's try it out in some of the colonies. And then when those colonies became countries, this was the only system that they were familiar with, so they kept the system. So it's sort of an historical accident why those countries kept them. And I guess that's the best answer I can give at this stage.
Thank you, Will. Elizabeth, David, Campbell, Ken, it's been wonderful to have such four exceptional political scientists be with, but you must remember you looked really good because you had exceptional assembly members asking you good questions. Thank you. It has been commented several times, we have come a long ways in five sessions. A couple of quick announcements, and then to see if you have any questions about logistics. The Prince George Planning Group, we want to have breakfast with them at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Then they're going to, the next session, they're going to give a report on kind of what's going on. Also, there's a, just to remind you, there's at 8 a.m., there's going to be a breakfast meeting at another table of the selection committee. You know, it's going to meet 8 a.m. Are there any other questions or announcements, or do you have anything you'd like to ask? This place is yours. I know between 5 and 6, if those of you don't want to go to the hotel, you can linger here. You can go to the concourse. The bar is going to be open there at 5:30. Douglas.
Jack, through to Mary. Mary, are you going to be posting the menus for the restaurants in Prince George for these members to see sometime this weekend?
That will be part of our discussion tomorrow morning at our meeting, and we will let the members know next week. Absolutely, we'll have some information for you. Look forward to it. Okay.
Chris.
This is a silly little request, but I think it'll make it easier for a lot of members traveling in and out of the circle here. When you leave your seats, just stand up and push your chair into the counter, and you'll find it'll be so much easier to do.
Any other? Yes, Deb.
Just wondering if anybody left here a couple weeks ago with the wrong key to their car. May have been their spare key, but they seem to have misplaced my key, and they had to bring a locksmith in to make a new one. So somebody might have a wrong key somewhere. It's for a Chrysler. It's silver with a black top.
And Sam has a... Sam?
I'm detecting a little animosity between Mr. Campbell and Dr. Carty, and I suggest you both don a hockey jersey and hammer it out in the middle.
right in the center there, right? That sounds like a good idea. On incidentals, by the way, someone lost or left a pair of glasses in here, and it's at the... You've got it, Linda? Okay, great. Ken, you got something to say? No more? Okay, thanks, all of you, and we will see you at dinner.